Good morning. I'm Kate McNally, your moderator for today, and I'm pleased to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Jim Rooney. Before we get started, I'd like to thank today's musicians, the Gap Mountain Trio, for recording the music many of you enjoyed while waiting for the live broadcast to begin. Boy, they were fabulous. Also, thank you to Peterborough Folk Music Society for generously sponsoring today's event. This program is dedicated to the memory of Joel Green, former member of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum and Peterborough Folk Music. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported primarily through contributions from our audience. We deeply appreciate your donations, which this year may be made on our website or by mailing your donation. During this challenging time, the Lyceum needs your help more than ever. Today's talk is being recorded and will soon be available as a podcast and as a video on our website, monadnocklyceum.org. The talk will also be rebroadcast on WSMN next Sunday at 11 a.m. and on WUML this coming Wednesday at 10 a.m. As is the tradition of the Lyceum, after the presentation, our speaker will answer questions from the audience. Please submit your questions by using the comments section on Facebook or YouTube, or send them to our email at monadnocklyceum@gmail.com. That's monlyceum@gmail.com. After the broadcast, you may provide feedback on today's program, suggestions for next summer's speakers, or join our mailing list through our website. Our speaker today is Jim Rooney. It's an honor to be with you today, and especially in an event dedicated to the late Joel Green, who I had the pleasure of serving on the Peterborough Folk Music Society board with. He was passionate about many things and serving others, and especially in his role to bring folk music to audiences in the Monadnock region with PFMS. I'm also especially honored to be on the same stage, that's stage, with a man whose encyclopedic knowledge of folk music and his experience as a musician and producer for venues like Club 47, Newport Folk Festival, and with extremely talented musicians like Bill Keith, Nancy Griffith, Iris Dement, and John Prine will be really hard to capture in a one-hour segment. For a more comprehensive view, you may dive into his books, In It for the Long Run, Musical Odyssey, or Boss Men, Bill Monroe and Muddy Waters, or his co-write, Baby Let Me Follow You Down. He's a Grammy Award-winning producer who, fortunately for us, lives nearby in Vermont. Please welcome Jim Rooney.
Well, thanks a million, Kate. And let me be one of the first to congratulate you. And I believe today you're going to be celebrating your 25th anniversary on NHPR with your folk show. And that's a good long run for anybody to keep going. And I really appreciate all the work you do to help this music keep get out to the world at large. It's we need a lot of people like Kate McNally in this world. Well, this morning, it's Sunday morning, isn't it? And here I am in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and I'm going to be talking to you this morning about songs and songwriting and singing. And how did this happen to me? I grew up in Dedham, Massachusetts, when I was not a hotbed of music, or not a hotbed of most anything, I don't think. At any rate, you don't know what's going to happen to you at different times in your life, and you just have to kind of be ready to take something when it's offered. And in this case, a friend of mine, I was going to a Latin school in Boston, Roxbury Latin School. I was in my second year there, and it was a tough old school, tough classical curriculum. And I was supposed to be heading to college and maybe a life of a teacher or something like that. And a friend of mine in school said, Oh, you should listen to this radio show. It's the funniest thing you've ever heard. And he says it's called the Hayloft Jamboree. It's on WCOP. It's on every night. He turned it in, and he told me how to do it. So I did. I listened. I turned it on. And the first thing I heard was this singing, real passionate Southern singing, high voices with fiddle and mandolin, banjo. And it was these two brothers, Everett and B. Lilly, the Lilly brothers, a banjo player named Don Stover and a fiddler named Tex Logan. They called themselves the Confederate Mountaineers because they were from West Virginia, except for Tex. And I'd never heard anything like this in my life. We call it bluegrass now, but bluegrass didn't have a name in 1951. And then right after that, this disc jockey came on named Nelson Bragg, and Nelson Bragg billed himself as the Merry Mayor of Milo, Maine. And he had a kind of a down east kind of shtick, but he was playing hillbilly music. And some people consider this to be sort of a golden age of hillbilly music. And people like Hank Williams was still alive. Hank Snow, Hank Thompson, a lot of Hanks. And I just got totally captivated. I started listening every single night. And the person that really got to me was Hank Williams. And so I'm going to sing a couple of those songs that got into me at that time, and then we can talk about it. I am going to show you, though, here are these albums that I bought back then. This is Moanin' the Blues, and we got Moanin' the Blues, Lovesick Blues, Honky Tonk Blues, Long Gone Lonesome Blues. I'm a long gone daddy. I'm so lonesome I could cry. The blues come around and my sweet love ain't around. Hank Williams, Moanin' the Blues, and I have that record still, and here's one of those songs. I went down to the river to watch the fish swim by. And when I got to that river, so lonesome I wanted to die. Oh, Lord. And then I jumped in the river, but the doggone river was dry. She's a long gone, and now I'm lonesome blue. Well, I had me a woman, and she couldn't be true. She made me for my money, and she made me blue. Man needs a woman that he can lean on. My leading post is on her left and gone. She's alone, gone, and now I'm lonesome blue. Well, she told me on Sunday she was checking me out. Along about Monday she was nowhere about. Here it is Tuesday, ain't had no news. I got them long but not forgotten blues. She's alone, gone, and now I'm lonesome blue. I'm gonna find me a river, one that's cold as ice. And when I find me that river, Lord, I'm gonna pay the price, oh Lord. I'm going down in it three times, Lord, I'm only coming up twice. She's alone, gone, and I'm lonesome blue. Well, that's how I got started singing those songs from that record. And what was going on here? And I had no idea at the time, except, and I probably still don't have much of an idea, but it was just moving me. This stuff, these songs of Hank Williams were really getting into me, and I suppose loosening up feelings that I didn't even know I had at the age of, I was 13, 14 years old. It's a confusing age. Well, as it's turned out, all age is confusing, but that's a very confusing age. And this music was a huge help to me to get into my own feelings. And this is the song that I think is just a masterpiece. Some people referred to Hank as the hillbilly Shakespeare. And his career only lasted for 4 years, from 1949 until the end of 1952 when he died. Quite an incredible career. So this is the song that really got to me. I'm so lonesome I could cry. Can't you hear that lonesome whippoorwill? He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. I never saw nights so long. The time goes crawling by. The moon just went behind a cloud to hide its face and cry. Well, did you ever see a robin weep when the leaves begin to die? Oh, that means he's lost the will to live. I'm so lonesome I could cry. Oh, the silence of a falling star lights up a purple sky. And as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry. Oh, as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry. Well, what can you say about that? It's just a wonderful, wonderful piece of writing, piece of song, and still, you can tell, gets to me. I don't know why exactly, but it gets to me. And I think that's what songs are for and why we want to write them and why we want to have them in our lives. You know, this is doing us a service to get this kind of thing in our lives. So that's how I got started. And I'm going to spare you all the details, but I actually became a star. I learned to play my Uncle Jim gave me a ukulele. I learned to play the ukulele. But the sad thing was that Hank died just at this point. And here I am. I had the records. I had the songbooks. I was eating, drinking, sleeping Hank Williams all the time, and then he died, New Year's Day, 1953. So there I was. But I kept going, and I did learn to play the ukulele, then the guitar, and I learned to sing some of these songs, and I screwed up my courage and auditioned for the Hayloft Jamboree when I was 16, and to my surprise, they let me on it. And so I did become a star there for a while. In 1954, I was playing at John Hancock Hall in Boston every Friday night, going out to play schools and churches with a band called Cappy Paxton and the Trailsmen. And it was going to be exciting. And then the station changed its format, and country music, hillbilly music, whatever they wanted to call it, was finished. And I'd worked all summer long selling vegetables by the side of the road and picking berries for this wonderful farming couple, Frank and Cora Sennett, to save up money to buy a guitar just like this, a Martin D18 guitar, saved $135. But I had the guitar and the show was gone. So what was I to do? Well, my mother understood something about, she originally, I think they thought this was going to be a passing thing and Jimmy would get over it and move on with his life. But she gave me this book, Carl Sandburg's American Song Bag. It doesn't look like much, does it? And I have mined this book for songs. I don't know how many songs out of this book. I've probably recorded about 15 songs that I learned. And I was just at home with my guitar by myself. And then I was, WCOP was in Boston in Copley Square. And right down the street was a bookstore called the Book Clearinghouse. And they had, I just wandered in there one day, and they had folk music records in the back. So I started picking them out. And here we go. Lead Belly. Lead Belly's Last Sessions. Here's a big one. Anthology of American Folk Music put together by a very crazy man named Harry Smith, with all these records from the 20s and 30s of people, the Carter family, people like that, Doc Boggs, all the original people, Big Bill Brunsey, all this stuff I bought back then when I was about 16. And I just was soaking up this music. And sorry, I hit the mic there. It was all kinds of music. It was not just hillbilly music, but I was going into the roots of the music. Now, Hank Williams came from Montgomery, Alabama. There's a lot of blues in his music. That opening song I did, that's a blues song. And he soaked up a lot of black music. And that was my introduction to the blues. It wasn't from a black singer at all. It was from Hank Williams. But then I got into Lead Belly and Big Brunsey and other things and the stuff on the Harry Smith anthology. And I was just doing this at home by myself. Then I went off to college. And in my third year of college, I met a kid who was learning how to play the banjo. Bill Keith was his name. He was from Brockton, Massachusetts. And so I said, well, I remember some of those songs the Lilly Brothers did. And so plus these songs I was getting out of the Carl Sandburg song bag were, you know, Southern, there was some Southern material there. And the beauty of having someone else to play with was that you could kind of get ideas. You got musical ideas from these songs that I was just getting out of a book. And so I'll do you a couple of the things that I started working on with Bill when I met Bill Keith. And one of them was the old ballad, Pretty Polly. A lot of murder ballads in the tradition, the banks of the Ohio, the Knoxville girl, all these sad stories about guys killing their girlfriends. I don't know why they're so popular, but they really are. And we wouldn't want to know these people, maybe, but we'd like to hear the stories sung. It's like, you know, watching a bad accident. But anyway, here's Pretty Polly. Oh, Polly, pretty Polly, come go along with me. Polly, pretty Polly, come go along with me. Before we get married, some pleasure to see. Well, she jumped up behind me and away we did go. She jumped up behind me and away we did go. Over the hills and dark valleys below. Well, we rode over hills and dark valleys so deep. We rode over hills and dark valleys so deep. Pretty Polly, she mistrusted and then began to weep. Oh, Willie, oh, Willie, I'm afraid of your ways. Willie, oh, Willie, I'm afraid of you waiting. The way we're rambling gonna lead me astray. Well, we rode on a little further and what did we spy? We rode on a little further and what did we spy? A new dug grave with a spade lying by. Oh, Polly, pretty Polly, your guess is about right. Polly, pretty Polly, your guess is about right. I've been working on your grave the long hours of last night. Oh, I opened her bosom as white as the snow. I opened her bosom just as white as the snow. I stuck to her heart and her heart was did flow. Oh, I throw on a little dirt and I turn to go home. I threw on a little dirt and I turn to go home, leaving only the trees and the wild birds to moan. Oh, Polly, pretty Polly, yonder she stands. Polly, pretty Polly, yonder she stands. Gold rings on her fingers, her lily white hand. Gold rings on her fingers are shining like gold. Gold rings on her fingers are shining like gold. Gotta see pretty Polly before she gets too old. Well, that's quite a story. As I said, those songs were really popular. And, you know, you can just see how these songs, that one actually has roots in England. And they were brought over into the Appalachians by mostly Scots-Irish people. Never knew what Scots-Irish people were until I lived in Ireland. And what it turned out to be was there were a lot of people cleared out of the highlands of Scotland at a certain point and urged to settle in Ulster in Northern Ireland. And those were, their descendants were called Scots-Irish. And those, a lot of those people were the people that wound up in the Appalachians, and they brought their songs with them. And of course, in time, the songs would change. But, and that one, you know, changed quite a bit, but it's still the basic story. And here's another one I got out of the Carl Sandburg song bag. And Bill Keith was working on a banjo tune, learning the changes that he'd heard. And it's an up-tempo tune. And for some reason, the words of this song, One Morning in May, came to mind. And I slowed it down and made it into a waltz, but I kept those chord changes. And this is what it is. One morning in May, I spied a fair couple making their way. And one was a maiden so bright and so fair, the other was a soldier and a brave volunteer. Good morning to thee. Oh, where are you going, my pretty lady? Oh, I'm going to the banks of the sea to see the waters gliding, hear the nightingale sing. Well, they hadn't been a standing but a minute or two, when out from his knapsack a fiddle he drew, and the tune he was playing made the valleys all ring. See the waters gliding, hear the nightingale sing. Pretty lady, it's time to give o'er. Oh no, pretty soldier, please play one tune more. For I'd rather hear your fiddle or the touch of one string than to see the waters gliding, hear the nightingale sing. Pretty soldier, will you marry me? Oh no, pretty lady, that never can be. I've a wife in old London and children twice three, two wives in the armies, too many for me. Well, I'll go back to London and I'll stay there 1 year, and often I'll think of you, my little dear. And when I return, it will be in the spring, to see the waters gliding, hear the nightingale sing. Well, that's a happier song than Pretty Polly. I've always been attracted to songs that had a bit of humor in them. The first one I did, The Long Gone Lonesome Blues, had a lot of humor in it. And it's a little bit of the laugh to keep from crying. But and this one has a nice kind of little humor at the end. That always appealed to me. And at this time, I took a course at Amherst College in my senior year, and it was given by a great curmudgeon of a professor named Theodore Baird. And his specialties were Shakespeare and the great novels of the 19th century, big, thick books. But this seminar was in oral poetry, like the Song of Beowulf, the Song of Roland, those kind of poems. And I looked into the English ballads, the child ballads, and found a great collection in the Amherst Library by A.L. Lloyd and Ewan McCall. And Baird's thing about teaching this course was that he did not understand this material. it was puzzling to him. The narratives were strange to him. He, as he said, well, you're going along and then there's a wall there. Where did that wall come from? And, you know, singing a song like Pretty Polly or whatever, you don't have the same expectations of a song that you do of a novel or a play. You've got a tempo and rhyme and melody and all these things to help move the story along and give it some atmosphere. And people don't even ask these questions, except he was asking them. But at any rate, that kind of sunk into my head that songs were different. And that summer, Bill, Keith, and I took our first trip to the South. I'd never been south of the Potomac. And as soon as we did cross the Potomac, we were on the Lee Highway and Route 11 over hill and dale through the Shenandoah Valley and listening to the radio and listening to country and hillbilly and bluegrass. By this time, bluegrass did have a name. And it was like going to another country. People talked differently. People ate different kinds of food. It was pretty sweet. Everything was a lot sweeter. And we got down to Asheville, North Carolina, and there was a little group of folkies from Boston and New York that went down to this festival hosted by a local folk song collector and lawyer named Bascom Lamar Lunsford. And actually, some of his songs were in that Harry Smith anthology. And so he welcomed us, and we were put on the show. And people kind of liked what we did. Bill had become quite a good banjo player just in 2 years. And people liked the way I was singing these songs with certain kind of emotional approach. And we were befriended by a fiddler named Bayard Ray, who took us up to his home at the end of a road up in the west hills of the Smokies there. And we met a wonderful singer named Aubrey Ramsey, who sang a lot of the old ballads and a beautiful voice and played the banjo. And Bayard's mother, Rachel, could sing those ballads all night long. And this is when I really got a feeling that I was joining a tradition of singers and songs. I wasn't from that culture, but I had been getting it from records and books and from the radio. And now I was joining it and I was being accepted. And that just meant the world to me. And then another thing happened to me about this time. I went to Harvard to study classics and in 1960. And just as I arrived there, I met a fellow there who named Adam Parry. And his father, Milman Parry, had gone to the Balkans in the 30s with a wire recorder and was recording these singers in cafes during the 40 days of Ramadan. And they were singing a long, long ballad about the fall of Constantinople, which had happened 1,000 years earlier. So this ballad, this material had been developing all that time. And he recorded it and then he analyzed the recording and he discovered that a lot of the people couldn't figure out how these singers could remember such a long piece of material. And he discovered that a lot of the material was formulaic. These phrases would come up again and again, and that was the way the singer could get through the song. And his research was interrupted by the Second World War, and then he died. But his student, Albert Lord, picked it up, and he published this book here. I'll get it out for you. It's called The Singer of Tales. This is just as I came to Harvard, and I read it. And it was very exciting. And I'm going to read you a piece from that. I've typed it out so I can read it, actually. So my eyes are getting bad. Okay, here we are. Now, this is what Lord was talking about. He said, there are two factors in oral composition that are not present in a written tradition. We must remember that the oral poet has no idea of a fixed model text to serve as his guide. He has models enough, but they are not fixed, and he has no idea of memorizing them in a fixed form. Every time he hears a song, it is different. Secondly, there is the factor of time. The literate poet has leisure to compose at any rate he pleases. The oral poet must keep singing. His composition, by its very nature, must be rapid. Individual singers may and do vary in their rate of composition, of course, but it has limits because there is an audience waiting to hear the story. If the singer has no idea of the fixity of the form of a song, and yet has to put his ideas into a more or less rigid rhythmic pattern in rapid composition, what does he do? To phrase the question a little differently, how does the oral poet meet the need of the requirements of rapid composition without the aid of writing and without memorizing a fixed form? His tradition comes to the rescue. Other singers have met the same need, and over many generations, there have been developed many phrases which express in the several rhythmic patterns the ideas most common in the poetry. These are the formulas of which Parry wrote. He learns them by repeated use of them in singing, by repeatedly facing the need to express the idea in song, and by repeatedly satisfying that need until the resulting formula, which he has heard from others, becomes a part of his poetic thought. He must have enough of these formulas to facilitate composition. He's like a child learning words, or anyone learning a language without a school method, except that the language here being learned is the special language of poetry. And that's when a teacher is most important. And Lord goes on to say, a young man decides at an early age, this is what I want to do, and goes through a long process of listening and learning from masters until he gets to the point where he can create the poetic song spontaneously. So that's where the Greek scholars who've been looking at the Iliad and the Odyssey as books hung up their robes. All that work was for naught. They had been approaching this material in an entirely different way. So I'm going to have to move along here. I can't stay all day, I understand. But I then started following some masters. One of the masters I got to know was Bill Monroe, through Bill Keith, who went to work for Bill Monroe in his bluegrass band. This kid from Brockton. And I'm going to sing a song of Bill Monroe's just to give you an idea of how great a writer he was and how it suited his music. It's about his Uncle Penn. All the people would come from far away and dance all night till the break of day. And the caller hollered, do-za-do, you knew Uncle Ben was ready to go. Or late in evening, about sundown, high on the hill and above the town, Uncle Ben played the fiddle, Lord, how'd it ring? You could hear it talk, you could hear it sing. He'd play an old piece called Soldier's Joy, and one he called the Boston Boy. But the greatest of all was Jenny Lind. To me, that's where fiddling begins. Late in the evening, about sundown, high on the hill and above the town, Uncle Penn played the fiddle, Lord, how'd it ring? You'd hear it talk, you could hear it sing. I'll never forget that mournful day when Uncle Penn was called away. They hung up his fiddle, hung up his bow, and it was time for him to go. Late in the evening, about sundown, high on the hill, and above of the town. Uncle Pim played the fiddle, Lord, how'd it ring? You could hear it talk, you could hear it sing. There, what a great song. What a picture it paints. And it just puts you in a place that is so beautiful. And it's a true song. And it's the words, the lyrics are just the way Bill Monroe spoke. To me, that's where fiddling begins. He would say that about that song, Jenny Lind, or things like that. So I was picking up on that kind of material. And another master I was following who had been on the Hayloft Jamboree, I didn't meet him at that time. His name was Jack Clement, Cowboy Jack Clement. And Jack Clement was up in Boston briefly playing with a trio on the Jamboree. Then he went back to Memphis, where he was from, and he started working at Sun Records. And he wrote a lot of songs that you would know, perhaps, like The Ballad of a Teenage Queen for Johnny Cash, or I Don't Like It, But I Guess Things Happen That Way for Johnny Cash. And here's one he wrote for, I don't have time for that, but I'm going to sing you a song about Jack. And when I went to Nashville and met Jack, I was accepted into this community of songwriters. And I was accepted there. And he was just a very unique figure and attracted a lot of very talented people to him. And two of them wrote about this group of people. And this is a song that they wrote, Alan Reynolds and Bob McDill, about Jack Clement. Jack was fascinated with space, and he was always talking about going to Alpha Centauri. So this is a song that I will leave you with, and it kind of sums up what I think what songs are for, and it is called We Must Believe in Magic. Matt is the captain of Alpha Centauri. We must be out of our minds. Though we are shipmates and bound for tomorrow, everyone here is lying blind. We must believe in magic. We must believe in the guiding hand. If you believe in magic, you'll have the universe at your command. Mad is the crew bound for Alpha Centauri, dreamers and poets and clowns. Old is the ship bound for Alpha Centauri. Nothing can turn it around. We must believe in magic. We must believe in the guiding hand. If you believe in magic, you'll have the universe at your command. La da da la da da da. La da da la da da da. La da da la da 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 da. La da da la da da da. We must believe in magic. We must believe in the guiding hand. If you believe in magic, you'll have the universe at your command. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Any questions?
We are going to give folks a chance to ask some questions. We have time for a few from the audience. And as Jim responds to those already sent, you can continue to submit your questions on Facebook and YouTube in the comments section or by sending an email to monlyceum@gmail.com. Jim, we did have a question about your guitar playing. Can you hold up your guitar?
I'm sorry. I apologize.
No. I mean, what kind of, you said you learned when you started catching the tunes from Hank Williams when you were like 13 and the lyrics got you, but what gets you in terms of guitar styling?
Well, I play backwards. You can't see that because we hid that in the shot here. Okay. I'm playing upside down and backwards because I didn't know any better. And it didn't seem to matter to me. I got a ukulele first. I'm left-handed. And I picked that up and I was learning. I could read the chords and I got my hands working that way. And then I got my hands on a guitar, very cheap plywood guitar, cost $12, very hard to play. And I wasn't trying to be Chet Atkins anyway. I thought Hank Williams, he had a band. He had people that play with him. And all he did was stand there and look good and strum. And I figured, well, that's good enough for me, good enough for Hank. And I will say that when I did meet Jack Clement in Nashville, Jack is a master. People don't pay too much attention to rhythm guitar, rhythm playing in general, but it is quite an important thing, especially when you're making records. And Jack had been a teacher at Arthur Murray. He believed that music should, and people should be able to dance to music. And if you can't dance to it, what's the point? So he was a wonderful rhythm guitar player. Played on a lot of records, people, Ring of Fire, I mean, all kinds of records that people know, but wouldn't know that he was playing rhythm guitar because it's never featured, but it's an important part of those records. And I learned a lot about playing rhythm guitar just from being around him. And I really enjoy it. I came to understand that it was an important thing, and you could actually get good at it, and I try to be good at it.
Jim, one of your former pals and former bluegrass boy with Bill Monroe was an innovator on the banjo, Bill Keith.
Yeah.
Can you think about innovators in songwriting, people perhaps that you have worked with who you consider real innovators in the songwriting realm?
Well, at the time, someone like John Hartford comes to mind immediately. I met John just as I was coming to the end of my tenure at the Club 47. And he came up to Cambridge. He knew there was a club and he was looking for jobs. And I had already heard Gentle on My Mind, I believe. And so I was very interested in meeting him. And that song, Gentle on My Mind, it broke a lot of rules and is one of the most performed songs in BMI's whole catalog. Another fellow that came along at the same time was Jerry Jeff Walker with Mr. Bojangles. Those songs were really great narrative songs with an interesting chord progressions, and changed the way a lot of people approached songs after that. And of course, I mean, you can't talk about this kind of subject without mentioning Bob Dylan. I mean, who's still doing it? I mean, his latest piece is 17 minutes long, about the Kennedy assassination, called Murder Most Foul. And he was always making up the rules for himself. But he soaked up, when I was talking about soaking up the tradition, he really soaked up a lot of music. And you can read his chronicles, and he was listening all the time. And if you were another songwriter, you wouldn't want to be humming one of your melodies around Bob Dylan, because you'd be hearing it back very shortly in some other form. But that's just the way he is. And I think it's a credit to him that he listened to so much and took so much in and is recycling all that material back out. I think that's what we do. You know, that's the way to do it. Not put it in amber and just say, oh, that song, that One Morning in May song I did, we made up that melody. And I played it in Ireland. It is known over there. And this woman came up to me afterwards and said, I liked that Morning in May, even if it was the wrong tune. So, you know, it was the wrong tune, but it's done okay for itself on its own. Yeah.
Jim, you talked about how you're drawn to senses of humor in writing styles. Is that what drew you to John Prine? You worked with the late John Prine for a time.
What I surely
was
it that did.
Was the humor what attracted you to?
Well, it's this mixture, like the Hank thing, the first song, the Long Gone Lonesome Blues, has a lot of humor in it. I'm So Lonesome I Cry has no humor in it. It's absolutely looking at it straight in the eye.
Right.
And I find that people like Prine also can do that. He has a lot of songs, Fish and Whistle, go fish and whistle, whistle and fish, eat everything you put on your dish, and when we get through, make a big wish that we'll never have to do this again. Father, forgive us for what we must do. You forgive us and we'll forgive you. And when we're all through, we'll go fish and whistle in heaven. I mean, a wonderful lyric like that. I've been singing a song of his written with another great songwriter, Roger Cook, and who wrote I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing in Simple Harmony, and Sandy Mason, who wrote When I Dream. And the three of them wrote this song called Only Love. And it's such a simple song. And I might sing just a tiny bit of it, because I have had it on my mind a lot since John passed. You may live alone and close your eyes. Some folks do. You may dream a dream that's twice your size all night through. But when the morning comes, who do you tell your dreams to? Only you. Only love, love, only, only love will do. Only love, love, only, only love comes true. Nothing else, you see, there's nothing else, only love. I have known a love within my heart, one or two, where one love would end and one would start, I never knew. If love should come your way, you'll learn to say, I love you, I love you. Only love, love, only, only love will do. Only love, love, only, only love comes true. Nothing else, you see, there's nothing else. Only love, only love. Only love, only love. I think songs are meant to help people. If that song helps me, it helps a lot of other people. And John Prine was one of those people, like Hank Williams, whose music just reached into people's hearts and made their lives better. And that's why I'm proud to be part of the songwriting community.
Thank you so much for curating the music, Jim Rooney. You're more than a producer, more than a musician, more than an author, but you have made a big difference by presenting today. Many people are responding and really appreciating what you're doing. We did have a question about yodeling, Jim. How does that happen?
it always gets a hand. I actually, on that Hayloft Jamboree, they had a champion yodeler as the host, Elton Britt. He had a song called The Cannonball Yodel, and he could really yodel. And I can't. But when I was learning, you know, Hank Williams songs, and to break my voice, it seemed to me that it would work better if I stood in front of a mirror and stretched my neck like this. And eventually, one day, it actually broke and worked, and then I could do it again. And I'm not a real yodeler, but it does seem, you know, in gospel music, there's also a thing where falsetto singing is very popular, both in black and white gospel singing. And I think it's a sign of the spirit. You know, it's getting you closer to God. The higher you can sing, closer you are to God. So I can't get that close, but you know, it's fun to do, you know.
And how many hours did you practice in the mirror?
Oh, who knows? I did like to stand in front of the mirror, so it wasn't a problem.
Now, Jim, COVID-19 has really had an impact on performers and just the whole music industry, you know. Right. First, we had, you know, streaming and the internet kind of robbing, in a sense, the livelihoods of many folks because CDs were not being sold. That's or true. Purchased. And now COVID-19 is really putting a damper on performances throughout. How are you, or how have you changed what you're doing in order to continue to reach out to musicians and the music industry?
Well, it's been hard. It's only, you know, it seems an eternity, but it really has only been 4 months. And so you just have to kind of figure out what it is you can do. And as in so many other areas, you have to be local, I think. Mm-hmm. We can't go traveling all over the world like we were, and we might not ever get back to the way we were in that way, traveling by plane all over the place. Of course, hillbilly music was always on the ground until not that long ago. All those artists on the Grand Ole Opry were traveling hundreds of miles by car every day, and we're probably going to get back on the ground, I'd say, and start working our, and originally country music was also based around radio stations. Mm-hmm. And the Monroes or the people like that, the Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs, they would go to a radio station and they would do a morning show for farmers and then do a lunchtime show at another station. And they work every school and church within the signal of that station for several months. And then they move to another station and do the same thing. It was all very local. At their records, they did make records, and those records did get out to the larger world. But so I have a feeling we're going to, if we can, at least we're able to play outdoors. Playing indoors is a problem. Right. I won't be able to go play with my band in Nashville until maybe a year from now. I don't know. But and that's really tough. But you have to get creative. It's nice to have something like this where you can reach people this way. So we'll see.
Jim, I love your book, In It for the Long Run. Just an amazing collection of memories. Any plans for another book?
No. Writing books is no fun. It's a lot of work. I did have fun writing the book with Eric von Schmidt about our life in Cambridge. We did have quite a bit, maybe a little too much fun writing that book. But it's hard work. And I'd rather sing songs or play or produce records. I love producing records. I love working in the studio. But those days are a little numbered too. But I've done the books.
So we can cross off author on your passion, on your list, on your bucket list.
Yeah, I've done that.
What are the things that what gives you the most joy? Is it performing? Is it producing? Your connections with the music industry? What is it that feeds
it's
your
spirit? It's all a tie, I suppose. I do enjoy performing a lot, but I've never really made my primary focus as an artist, because to be a real artist, you have to have a lot of absolute determination and focus and talent. And I didn't feel that I was capable of doing that. But what I am capable of and what I have been able to do is help other people get their music out to the world, whether by running the Club 47, getting a good, I've always been concerned with the conditions of performance. I was a tour manager. I was a concert, put on concerts and put on club. And I always wanted things to be right for the artist. And making records in the studio, I always want the artist to feel really comfortable and to almost forget that they're making records. And I've been fortunate enough to work with such very, very talented people in Nashville, songwriters and musicians, that it's a sheer pleasure to go to work every day and make music and have it go out to the world and affect people's lives. And that's very satisfying. And I really enjoy that work. I've worked with some of these people for 30, 40, 50, almost 50 years in some cases. And we know each other very well, and we get along, and we can do what we do very quickly and well. And it works in the world, in the outdoor world. It gets out there to people, and people appreciate it. So that means a lot to me.
Thank you so much for sharing yourself with us today, Jim.
Well, and congratulations to you.
Thank you.
My book is called In It for the Long Run, and you're definitely in it for the long run. And you mentioned earlier you've been in radio for 40 years.
I have, yeah.
25 at the folk show, and that's a great achievement. Yeah, it's wonderful. But we do this because we love it, obviously.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're right. Thank you so much to the Peterborough Folk Music Society for sponsoring this program today. Our program next Sunday will feature Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. They'll present They Said It Couldn't Be Done, illustrating philosophical ideas with jokes. We hope you've enjoyed today's live broadcast of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Thank you so much for your support of our unique 2020 season. Thank you for all of your questions today, and to you for joining us on this broadcast. We hope you'll do it again next week. You can send your speaker any questions that you might have of the Monadnock Lyceum to monlyceum@gmail.com. Again, thank you very much for participating in today's program. Don't forget, you can also check out the website to find out when you can hear this broadcast again, in case you joined us late or you would just like to go back and hear Jim and his music one more time. Thank you so much. Thank you.